This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Previously on the history of Singapore. In late July 1962, new British Secretary of State for the Colonies, Duncan Sandys, met with Tunku Abdul Rahman and Lee Kuan Yew. The three of them agreed that they would arrest Singapore's political opposition. They would do it via a formal process through Singapore's Internal Security Council. They would take equal responsibility for the arrests. And the arrests would be timed to happen sometime after the passage of the Malaysia Bill through the UK Parliament in February 1963. The only question then was who to arrest and when exactly to arrest them. Seems straightforward? It was anything but. Join us today for the thrilling conclusion to this story. Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore. Episode 44, Operation Cold Store Part 2, The Blame Game. As recounted in Episode 42, on 1st September 1962, Lee Kuan Yew won Singapore's national referendum on merger by giving the people of Singapore a Hobson's choice. Buoyed by the referendum victory, Lee's old habits resurfaced. The impatience, the arrogance, the contempt, the disdain for process over outcome. All the things that UK Commissioner Lord Selkirk had despaired of. They now came back with a vengeance. Contrary to the plan agreed in London with Sandys and the Tunku, Lee went to British officials in Singapore and argued that now was the time to make arrests as the opposition were momentarily weakened by the referendum result. The British disagreed. Deputy UK Commissioner Philip Moore felt that, quote, "The referendum result has demonstrated conclusively that Singapore can be governed through parliamentary democracy without resort to totalitarian methods," unquote. While Lord Selkirk said, quote, "The referendum has proved very much what I always thought, that Singapore's electorate is not under the dominating control of communist forces. The real danger is rank stupidity of statement from either prime minister," unquote. You can tell Selkirk was really frustrated with the Tunku and Lee at this point. This was not the first time he called their actions stupid in his dispatches to London. It would not be the last. In the Federation, Tun Razak and Dr. Ismail also rejected Lee Kuan Yew's plan, telling him to stick to what had been agreed. Lee declared that he was, quote, "thoroughly disgusted with the rigid Federation attitude," unquote, and demanded an Internal Security Council meeting as soon as possible. But as luck would have it, on the day of the meeting, Lee Kuan Yew was in London, and so Toh Chin Chai stood in for him, and Toh shocked Tun Razak by completely dismissing the need for arrests and agreeing with Selkirk that any arrest would make the situation worse. And so the council agreed that, in accordance with what was agreed in London, Special Branch would prepare a new paper making the case for the arrests, which would be ready by the next meeting scheduled for November. On his return, a furious Lee lashed out at Toh Chin Chai. Lee demanded the Internal Security Council reconvene in October, a month ahead of schedule. At this meeting, the new Special Branch paper was, of course, not yet ready. But Lee still demanded action. Now, now, now. Selkirk refused to discuss arrests until the new paper was ready. "Let's just stick to what everyone had agreed to," he said. "They were winning. Malaysia was going to happen. So why deviate from the plan now just to satisfy Lee's impatience?" And Lee Kuan Yew lost it. In his report to London, Selkirk records that, quote, "Lee then went off in a long harangue, at times personally offensive to me," unquote. Lee threatened he would, quote, "withdraw the Singapore members from the Internal Security Council and leave us and the Federation to do what we liked," unquote. Selkirk writes, quote, "This meeting has shown even more clearly that Lee intends, in effect, to make the Internal Security Council primarily responsible for internal security between now and merger and to duck responsibility himself as much as possible," unquote. Later, sensing he had gone too far, Lee came back to Selkirk and blamed the Federation for his anger, saying that, quote, his aim was to see that just enough action was taken against the communists in Singapore to satisfy the Federation that the position was reasonably in check. And he elaborated, if he did not agree to repressive action before Malaysia, Tunku would regard him as a welsher and a coward, who could never be relied upon. And what was worse, the Tunku would go in for a wholesale policy of repression after Malaysia, which would alienate all Chinese, unquote. Selkirk was, shall we say, not convinced of Lee's sincerity, nor very impressed by Lee blaming his temper on the Federation leaders. So, everything seemed stable for the time being. All they had to do was wait for the passage of the Malaysia Bill through the UK Parliament in February 1963. Assuming, of course, Lee Kuan Yew did nothing stupid before then, which was not a given. But, of course, history has a way of surprising us all. On the morning of 8th December 1962, the Brunei Rebellion broke up. That was, by coincidence, 21 years to the day and hour of the Japanese invasion of Malaya. Rebels from the Parti Rakyat Brunei swiftly captured a number of oil installations and overwhelmed the small British garrison. The British were taken by surprise by the speed and coordination achieved by the rebels. British troops had to be flown in, and it took around 10 days to put down the rebellion. Precisely why the Brunei Rebellion started is a matter of historical contention, because it made little sense in and of itself. The leader of the Parti Rakyat Brunei, A.M. Azahari, had complete control of all elected positions in Brunei. In August 1962, the Parti Rakyat Brunei won 55 out of 55 seats of local elections and won 16 out of 33 seats in the Legislative Council. Plus Azahari's seat, that gave them 17 out of 33, which was an absolute majority. He had a good relationship with the Sultan of Brunei and was working towards a reunification of the three British territories in Borneo, to be called Kalimantan Utara, which would have the Sultan of Brunei as the constitutional monarch. At the time of the rebellion, Azahari was in Manila negotiating for Filipino recognition of Kalimantan Utara, which would have cemented Azahari's position in Brunei and his relationship with the Sultan. Azahari would then have taken Kalimantan Utara into Malaysia as a single entity, by far the largest member of Malaysia and definitely richest in terms of natural resources, strong enough to resist Kuala Lumpur or Singapore. So why on earth declare a rebellion? The British were terrified about Azahari ruining the Malaysia plan. He had run on an election promise that he would oppose joining Malaysia on the terms proposed by the Tunku and instead proposed that the British return the sovereignty of North Borneo and Sarawak to Brunei and federate the three territories. He would have then proposed and passed his motion through the Legislative Council. This, of course, would have utterly destroyed the democratic legitimacy of the Tunku's and Lee's proposed structure of Malaysia. To avoid this, the British simply never convened Brunei's Legislative Council. They put it off in September, again in October, and again in November. That's a British tactic as old as Parliament itself. Charles I, for example, tried to go as long as he could without a Parliament. But he eventually had to pass a budget and levy taxes, and so would the Brunei government. They would have to eventually convene the council, and then Azahari would win. So according to historian Greg Polgrain, who interviewed Roy Henry, who was then head of Brunei's special branch, it was special branch which intervened. They had previously penetrated the inner circle of Parti Rakyat Brunei leadership. And while Azahari was away in Manila, Roy Henry arrested several Parti Rakyat Brunei members in Sarawak, leaked information that he was about to do the same in Brunei, and used his agents within the PRB to motivate the militant elements in the party to preemptively launch a rebellion. Now, the problem is that Paul Green's account is based solely on his interview with Roy Henry, so we do need some corroboration. But it is persuasive and does fit the facts. Hopefully we'll learn more about it one day when documents are declassified in the UK. The reason we took this detour is to give some context to what happened next in Singapore. Amidst the shock, it was noted that Azahari had been in Singapore a few days prior and lunched with Lim Chin Siong at Tiong Hua Restaurant on Prinsep Street. According to George Bogas, head of Singapore's special branch, who openly observed them from a nearby table, Azahari had attempted to sell a skeptical Lim Chin Siong on the idea of armed rebellion, which Lim flat out refused. After the rebellion, the Barisan issued a statement supporting anti-colonial revolution, supporting the Brunei rebellion. It declared that the Brunei rebellion demonstrated the strength of popular unhappiness against the Malaysia plan and should be supported by all genuine anti-colonialists. This was a similar statement to what they had previously put out when they were still part of the PAP to condemn Lumumba's assassination or support Ferhat Abbas, or indeed to support anti-colonialism in Aden, in Cyprus, in Vietnam, or many African states. But still, the Federation leaders and Lee seized upon the statement. Lee declared that by issuing the statement, the Barisan had provided, quote, a heaven-sent opportunity of justifying action against them, unquote. Never mind, of course, that his party had also issued many such statements in the past. But now, if accompanied by arrests in Sarawak and the Federation, arrests in Singapore would appear to be a natural response to the rebellion. The Federation declared that this was evidence of their argument for preventative arrests, and this was the, quote, tactically ideal moment, unquote. Selkirk, in his capacity as Commissioner General in Southeast Asia, flew to Brunei to meet the Sultan. On his return, he cabled his boss in London, Colonial Secretary Duncan Sands, asking for permission to conduct arrests. Now, this telegram to Sands has been used endlessly to show that Selkirk had evidence to arrest the Barisan. So let's read the reason Selkirk gave in the telegram. And he writes, quote, I have this morning carefully reviewed with my advisers the case for taking action at this time. The following, I believe, are the main factors in favour. A. Although we have not yet heard much at first hand from the Federation, we must expect to find them in a mood to brush aside all objections to their long-pressed demand for action now that events in Borneo have shown how much can be planned undercover. When the full significance of the changed situation in Borneo and the full prospects there are realized, their enthusiasm for Malaysia may be damped, and they will attach even more importance to securing the position in Singapore in the only way they believe to be effective. We should need very powerful arguments indeed to oppose them in this right now, and even with such arguments, our refusal might cause them to break down on the whole policy of Malaysia, unquote. So, you'll notice, Selkirk's big reason for the arrest has nothing to do with communism or Brunei or the Barisan statement or security. He starts off with the fundamental problem I discussed last week. To recap, the Federation leaders wanted the arrests, but Selkirk felt there was no basis or reason for them. So he was trying to play for time to keep the Federation happy enough not to pull out of the Malaysia plan while staving off the arrest of Singapore's political opposition. And his big point is that now there is no way I can keep the Federation happy without resorting to arrests. Also, we know that by this time Selkirk had already been overruled by his boss, Duncan Sands, and told that arrests would eventually happen. So Selkirk is looking for a face-saving way out for everyone. Selkirk knows an opportunity when he sees one, and he feels they have to grab it now. And if it was indeed true that the Brunei Special Branch instigated the rebellion, well, doubly so to make sure that the efforts do not go to waste. Selkirk had just been to Brunei to speak with Roy Henry. What did they talk about? We don't know. There are still many documents classified in the British National Archives, but the possibility is there. Selkirk then writes, quote, B. Recent security evidence has shown more clearly than ever before that the Barisan are communist-controlled and that although they see at least no feasible alternative to constitutional tactics, they have weighed the merits of more direct action and would not hesitate to take it if it would pay, unquote. Okay, so this paragraph is very heavily cited by those who argue that it shows that there was evidence. And the problem used to be that until 2014, this quote-unquote, recent security intelligence that Selkirk cited was still classified. But it was declassified in 2014, and so now we know. There was no evidence. The evidence which Selkirk cited was accounts of two post-referendum Barisan meetings. As you'll remember from a previous episode, the Barisan members believed, and quite correctly, that the PAP had manipulated the constitutional system to win the referendum on merger and were furious. So after the referendum, Lim Chin Siong gave a speech to calm down the party, in which he said, quote, the PAP used threats and cheated to gain victory. The people can clearly see that if the PAP can juggle with the law and threaten and cheat today, they will be able to do so tomorrow. So it will not be easy to restore public confidence in the parliamentary democratic system. But as long as the authorities preserve the conditions for peaceful constitutional struggle, we will continue to carry out peaceful constitutional struggle. If the PAP continue to cheat and threaten, we will keep exposing their cheating and threats. If they want to juggle around with and break the parliamentary democratic system, they have to bear all the consequences. We won't wallow in the muck with them. So you see clearly that Lim Chin Siong is committed to working with the constitutional system as long as the British permit it. He knows that the British may suspend the constitution and resume direct rule like they did in British Guyana, or arrest them all and throw them in jail as they had already done in the past. He accepts that he can't control that. But he said, quote, so long as the conditions for peaceful constitutional struggle remain available to us, we will persist in using them, unquote. So Selkirk's assertion that they were not ruling out more direct action is a misinterpretation of Lim's statement. Deliberate or otherwise, we don't know, but it is a misinterpretation because it is clear that Lim was speaking about the importance of maintaining integrity and public faith in the constitution. Now, the Barisan members gathered to discuss strategy after Lim's speech, and it is accounts of these meetings, written by a special branch spy inside the Barisan, that Selkirk is referring to. And in these meetings, Barisan members complained that the constitution was pointless if it was so easily manipulated, and they asked if there was another way forward. Selkirk chose to interpret these as calls to abandon constitutional action. But he disregarded the conclusions of the meeting, which was a unanimous agreement to keep following peaceful constitutional action. And indeed, in his speech, Lim Chin Siong explicitly rejected violence. And the account of the Barisan meetings shows clearly they were committed to peaceful constitutional progress and never once mentioned communism. And interestingly, unlike previously, Selkirk does not report the opinion of MI5 on this recent intelligence. But in a later telegram discussing this same supposed evidence, Philip Moore notes that MI5 felt, quote, both the Singapore and Federation special branches tried to slant the evidence in a way which was unacceptable, and he expressed great difficulty with this accuracy, unquote. Hence, you see that if you take Selkirk's statement, item B in his telegram, as at face value, it seems damning. But if you look at the context, the evidence, his motivations, his fears, if you read between the lines, it's quite clear that what Selkirk is doing is looking for a reason to satisfy the Federation government and save the Malaysia plan. He knows that arrests are inevitable, and this is the best opportunity, so let's just do it and get it over with. But honestly, as we discussed last week, even if the Barisan had said nothing, even if the Brunei rebellion never happened, they would still have been arrested anyway. That was the Tunku's price for Malaysia. So, in response to Selkirk's telegram, Sands sent a reply personally approved by Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. He agreed that as the arrests were inevitable, given the demands from the Federation, the rebellion provided, quote, the best possible background against which to take this action, unquote. And he urged that action be taken as soon as possible because any possible delay decreased the case for the arrest. Lord Lansdowne, Minister of State, was dispatched to Singapore to oversee the situation. A meeting of the Internal Security Council was held the following day, 13 December, and the new special branch paper approved as the rationale for the arrest, despite no one actually having read the paper in detail. Lee Kuan Yew said, quote, he had had no time to study the paper and would not wish to commit himself to the particulars of it, unquote. Dr. Ismail declared, quote, it does not matter about the cases as long as we have them in, unquote. It was agreed they would take equal joint responsibility for the arrests, although, of course, there was some haggling over the wording of the press release. As Sarawak had already conducted their own arrests, it was imperative the arrests in Singapore and the Federation were conducted as quickly as possible. Operation Cold Store was set for 2 a.m. on 16th December 1962. And then it didn't happen. Find out why when we return. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thum. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, Operation Cold Store Part 2, The Blame Game. Operation Cold Store was set for 2 a.m. on 16th December 1962. And it didn't happen. At the last minute, Lee Kuan Yew inserted 15 opposition politician names not approved by special branch into the list. When the Tunku learned of this, he erupted into fury and in turn refused to sanction the arrest of any Federation politicians. Lord Selkirk, Lord Lansdowne and Federation security officers tried to either convince Lee to withdraw the names or the Tunku to accept them, but both refused to budge. The Tunku, quote, took strong exception to Lee taking advantage of the operation in order to dispose of his political opponents. This, he said, was typical of Lee, who was a thoroughly untrustworthy man. He added, I cannot work with this fellow. I think we had better carry on with Malaysia without Singapore. The Tunku did not want accusations that he was also using the operation to rid himself of his opponents in the Federation. Selkirk felt Lee was, quote, utterly unreasonable and could put forward no convincing argument why the additional names should be included, unquote. Lee offered to back down if he could be absolved from any responsibility. Lansdowne felt Lee had simply lost his nerve, chickened out. And so the operation was called off at 2:30 a.m. Lord Selkirk desperately tried to resurrect the arrests before word of the operation leaked. Tempers were high on both sides of the causeway. An angry Tunku officially withdrew the Federation from the Security Council. The Federation demonstrated their own resolve and commitment by arresting 50 people, removing the possibility of joint action with Singapore. Lee also threatened to leave the Security Council. When Selkirk pressed him about the 15 names, Lee blamed Ong Pang Boon, saying, quote, they were put forward by his Minister for Home Affairs and not by him, unquote. Leaving the British to sort out the situation, he fled for the Cameron Highlands and refused all further attempts to contact him until the new year. As a parting shot, he wrote an official letter to the British which deliberately omitted information in order to present the Tunku and the British as responsible for the operation's failure. It was classified temporarily secret, a clear threat to publish if merger failed. The British and the Federation agreed that an operation in Singapore remained possible, but only on the basis of equal responsibility. Everyone had to share in the blame. However, Singapore ministers could not commit to anything in Lee Kuan Yew's absence, and so everyone sat and stewed for nearly 2 weeks as Lee played golf with Norodom Sihanouk. merger teetered on the edge as tempers frayed. In frustration, the Tunku pleaded to leave Singapore out of Malaysia, but the British refused. As time passed, the rebellion became less of an excuse for the arrest, but Selkirk felt that the point of no return had been crossed. Criticism of Malaysia as a neo-colonial construction was preferable to the Tunku dropping Singapore. On Lee's return to Singapore in the new year, his story changed. He declared that his intransigence had been because, once the arrests were carried out, the Tunku would no longer have any reason to take Singapore. This would completely undermine Singapore's negotiating position on constitutional and economic issues. What if he carried out the arrests and then the Tunku backed out of merger, leaving Lee to hold the bag? He had clearly spent his time in Cameron Highlands thinking of an excuse. So he repeatedly asked for written assurances that merger would occur once the arrests were made. And UK High Commissioner to Malaysia, Geoffrey Tory, pointed out that this would insult and infuriate the Tunku, a Malay aristocrat and a gentleman, and weaken his resolve for Malaysia at a time where Sukarno was attacking Malaysia as a neo-colonial plot. Philip Moore pointed out that, quote, if the arrests are justified, they should be made irrespective of Malaysia, unquote, and that there was, quote, a real risk the Tunku will try to drop Singapore from Malaysia if the arrests are not carried out, unquote. Tun Razak simply dismissed any idea that the Tunku would fail to keep his word. Under heavy pressure from the Federation and from London, it was agreed that the operation would be remounted. Lee then offered to drop his demand for a written guarantee of merger in exchange for references to Malaysia being included in the post-arrest press release. Duncan Sands refused because this would allow Lee to escape responsibility by claiming that the arrests were a condition of merger. They had agreed to equal responsibility, and Lee openly admitted he wanted to escape responsibility. He still feared the political price of arrests and sought to guarantee as much as possible his own survival after the arrest. He refused to proceed unless Malaysia was mentioned in the press release. However, Lee, the coward, did not dare to raise it with the Tunku, but instead pressed the British to negotiate on his behalf. After several failed rounds of frantic shuttle diplomacy, the British managed to get everyone into the same room, at which point a compromise was hammered out. The press release contained the references to Malaysia, thus allowing Lee to escape some responsibility. But even this was not enough, because Lee then asked for an annex to be attached to the press release, summarising the so-called communist conspiracy for public consumption. The British agreed, feeling that this would also help convince the UK Parliament of the necessity of the arrest. However, the annex was so inaccurate and so biased that the British had to make extensive last-minute alterations to remove, quote, a rather slanted account of the political events of 1956-57 whose inclusion was inappropriate and unnecessary, unquote. Those were the words of Philip Moore. See, Lee was just terrified of the consequences of the arrests. He knew they were politically unjustifiable, so he kept wanting to add more names to ensure his own political survival after the arrest. On 17 December, he had proposed a smaller operation to arrest 30 people. 3 days later, he suggested 70. Now, in mid-January, he wanted over 180. He directed Special Branch to reinsert 3 of the 15 controversial names, specifically 3 of Ong Eng-Guan's lieutenants in the United People's Party. An upset Philip Moore tackled him on the inclusion of the names, pointing out that they were not communists and there were no grounds for arresting them. And Lee did not dispute this. He admitted it was, quote, to strengthen his own chances of political survival, unquote. Selkirk felt they could not sanction, quote, political arrests designed to cow an opposition party, unquote, and asked Sands for authority to refuse to hold the operation if Lee did not drop the names. Both Sands and the Tunku agreed that Lee was, again, using the operation for his own political ends and repeatedly tried to get Lee to back down. But Lee threatened to cancel the entire operation if the 3 were not included. And unwilling to risk Malaysia, Sands and the Tunku eventually, reluctantly, agreed to arrest the 3 men. Selkirk pleaded for them to reconsider, but but Sands overruled him. Selkirk thus reluctantly approved the operation, which was duly carried out on 2nd February 1963. Over 130 politicians, trade unionists, and activists were arrested. Singapore's opposition was wiped out. Till today, Singapore has never again reached the heights of democracy that we enjoyed in those years between 1955 and 1963. This is the horrible cost of Operation Cold Storm. It robbed us of many of our anti-colonial heroes, people who helped make Singapore independent and would have helped make Singapore truly great. So, the fierce battle between the British, the Federation, and Lee Kuan Yew was never about security or communism. It was about who would take the blame for the unjustifiable arrest of the Barisan. And Lee went to extreme lengths to escape blame. Indeed, after Cold Storm, Lee came out and blamed Cold Storm on the Federation and the British, saying it was a condition of merger. Cold Storm was an act of cold-blooded political murder by the British Federation and Singapore leaders designed to keep two pro-British politicians, Lee and the Tunku, in power in Malaysia. In a future episode, I'll discuss all the ways in which Cold Storm has impacted Singapore's future, but for today, I think it's important to simply reiterate that it is clear that Cold Storm was a political operation, not a security decision. Some, of course, argue that Cold Storm was necessary to make Singapore better off today, but I personally fail to see how destroying the lives of innocent men and women contributed to Singapore's prosperity. And indeed, even if Singapore's success was because of Cold Storm, is it worth the cost to have destroyed lives and broken families?
And the crowd getting excited. There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa. Mrs. Winnie Mandela next to him, waving to the crowds. Hand in hand, they leave the Victor Verster prison.
Or to put it another way, Nelson Mandela was jailed for 27 years. If in that time the National Party had turned South Africa into a rich and prosperous nation, would you then accept that Mandela's jailing had been worth it? I think your answer to that question should be the same as your answer to whether Cold Storm was worth it. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.